Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Older Militarist Radio. We come to you live once again from 8:30 a.m. in the Central Time Zone. We have a lot of breaking news coming up in the show. Just before we went live about 2 minutes ago, we received the new report from Gatestone Institute, and boy, it's a doozy. The title is "The United Kingdom is funding textbooks that teach children to blow themselves up." We'll get into that later, but first, let's do some good news stories before we get into the dark side. Dun, 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 dun. Sorry, I'm feeling good right now. Better than I did yesterday. Yesterday, while we were doing our show on Twitter censorship that we couldn't do the day before, I found out from the president of Order Militaris Catholicus that yesterday was the anniversary of crowning King St. Edward the Confessor. How many years has it been? Well, according to the calculator I use, 976th anniversary. That is a long time, folks. I found a blog post on it, on the actual crowning event. I'm hoping it tells a little bit about what was recorded, so we can sort of go back and see and take a peek, as they say, into what was it like when our king, my grandfather, great grandfather, was crowned king of England, and what would be known as today the United Kingdom. And boy, they sure used him to the house. But that's for later in the show. Right now, we're going to celebrate the anniversary of the crown of St. King Edward the Confessor. Pray for us. Alright, I found this on it's a tattered name of the blog, but Squadcation, blog crowning Edward Confessor, 60-second histories on the crowning of Edward Confessor. So, let's see what they got. It took place April 3rd, 1042 A.D. Vitae Edwardi Regis, the book on the life of Edward, commissioned by his wife, is from the Anglo-Saxon king, as of outstanding height and distinguished by his milky white hair and beard, full face and rosy cheeks, thin white hands and long transition fingers. He was pleasant but always dignified. He walked with his eyes downcast and very affable to all. He was the first and only Anglo-Saxon king canonized by Pope Alexander III, and was the one of national saints until St. George was officially adopted around 1350 by Edward III, who created the Order of the Garter. Edward's feast day is 13th of October. King Edward was born around 1003 AD, was the surviving son of Ethelred, known as the Unready due to losing his throne to the Swent in Canute, and his second wife, Emma Normandy. He was half-brother of the English king, Hardy Canute, who was brought up in exile in Normandy and lacked military ability and reputation. He is said to have had a very unhappy childhood, away from his home and his family. On becoming king of the Anglo-Saxon, Chronicle tells us that one of his first acts was to deprive his mother of her estates and leave her in poverty for the rest of her life. Such were his feelings of anger towards her and his situation. His common sympathies and patronage continued between the English earls, especially Earl Godwin of Wessex. Probably the most powerful of them all, despite Edward marrying Godwin's daughter. Names are going through my head. It's like flashbacks to my ancestors, or flashbacks to my hands. They married in 1045, with two fell out to such an extent that Earl Wessex raised an army against Edward. With the help of the Earls of Mercia and Northumberland, the king managed to banish him and exile his wife from court in 1051. During this exile, Edward brought in the Normans to places at court and act as sheriffs around the country to shore up his reign. It is also said that early in 1051, William, Duke of Normandy, later William I Conqueror, was designated heir to the English throne when he came to visit. And I also learned just recently they found adoption papers. So what we know here in modern times is adulthood adoption. That is what happened to William the Conqueror. That is why he was designated heir to the throne of England. All right. The hostile reaction to this brought Godwin back in 1052. However, during a royal banquet in 1053, he collapsed and died, and his place was taken by his son, Harold, who formed a much closer alliance with Edward. He led the royal army as his deputy, and in many ways ran the country. The last 15 years of Edward's reign were relatively peaceful. Techniques in agriculture improved prosperity, and the population rose to around 1 million people. Taxation was light, and as Edward lived off the revenues of his estates, roughly 5,500 pounds, there were no expensive military campaigns. Trade was also good with mainland Europe. Something modern-day UK could learn. As I heard, their debt is just bad as ours. Horrible. Edward was also deeply religious and had commissioned the building of Westminster Abbey. His devotion to prayer is the reason for his nickname of Confessor, although some of this is more down to legend and hearsay rather than fact. He had a fierce temper and a rage, loved to hunt and sometimes seize lands to gain the revenues from him. Appointed Stickgin as Archbishop of Canterbury, who also controversial as he was disappointed for over 100 years, he was not a monk. Stickgin was dismissed by many churchmen due to his plurality, as he held appointments at both Winchester and Canterbury. So he was both Archbishop at Winchester and Canterbury, which I think are opposite ends of the map of England. Yeah, that would be kind of hard. Because you're like the head abbot Canterbury. Help take care of the monks. And also the diocese there. Then you're also the bishop of Winchester. So you're basically like the modern bishop today who either have one diocese that is in a large spread over area, or you get two spread over a large area. That means a lot of travel time. Since they didn't have cars back then, probably on horseback or by foot. Well, we're getting some Twitter action here. Alright, let's go back now. In 1064, Edward sent Harold, Duke of Wessex, to confirm the promise he had made to William back in 1051. Harold swore on holy relics to reconfirm this. Although the legality and what he was forced into doing this remain unclear, the Bailiff's type of history shows this event. And there are both Norman and Saxon accounts that differ widely in their interpretation. In November 1065, though he became ill, although he recovered somewhat, his condition deteriorated on Christmas Eve that year, causing him to miss the consecration of Westminster Abbey. He did manage to attend Christmas Day banquet, however. Although it was customary for a monarch to name his successor, it usually went to the son of the monarch. However, Edward had no children, and the role of electing the new king was up to the group known as the Witan, which is an old English word for a meeting of wise men. So basically like a papal conclave. A group of cardinals who are in college of the cardinals who are still eligible to vote, sit around, discuss, take a tally. No vote means no whoever. Yay vote means yeah, king. These were the king's advisors and were present. While Edward lay dying, the first criterion was that the new king must be English. Others were that he should be of good character and of royal blood. As they waited for his death, Edward woke and began to speak about the dream he had. Two normal monks he knew had come to place a curse on England. One year after his death, devils would bring fire, a sword, and war to punish the country for the wickedness of its earls and clergy. This curse would only be lifted when a green tree felled halfway up its trunk, and with one part cut off and taken 3 furlongs away, would rejoin it and start to grow again. Archbishop Canterbury dismissed us as the raving of a dying man, but others were worried, especially with William, Duke of Normandy, waiting across the channel, claiming the throne. Edward was seen as a pious man with a reputation, prophesying the future. However, this was all overshadowed when Edward offered his hand to Earl Harold, his brother-in-law, and placed England into his protection. He then fell back into a coma and died on January 5, 1066. The following day, the Witan confirmed this appointment unanimously. An Englishman, the most powerful man in the country, and proven soldier. No mention was made of William in the promises made in 1051 and 1064. Edward was buried in Westminster Abbey on the same day Harold was crowned. Back in Normandy, William was seizing. He was to build a fleet, an army, that was to smash Anglo-Saxon England forever. Harold's reign was to last just 9 months, and the country was about to be subsumed into the rest of Europe. How long that lasts will depend on the referendum to be held 23rd June 2016. Just 950 days, 50 years later. Oh my word. Oh my word. Yeah, sorry. That is this, yeah. Yeah. Let me read where this tree is supposed to be. Doesn't say where this tree is supposed to be. But, yeah. See if I can get. I'm gonna see if I can get someone on to discuss this. Yeah. Hold on, right quick. I'm seeing if the President of Board of Mail test can come on or something. 2 minutes. Alright. Doesn't say where this tree is supposed to be. What a green tree. Halfway up, half of it is taken 3 furlongs away, and we would rejoin and start grow again. Where's this tree at, Grandpa? How can we save England? How can we save England? I don't know where that tree would be. I don't know. Hopefully, in the books, there's got to be some clue where this tree would be have to go. Hey. Sorry, my dog's barking here. Hey, stop it. We're on air here. Anyway, says King Edward woke and began to speak about a dream he had. Two Norman monks he knew had come to a place, a curse on England. 1 year after his death, devils would bring fire, a sword, and war to punish the country for the wickedness of its earls and clergy. That would mean the coming of William the Conqueror to get what was promised to him, rightfully by King Edward. But also, does that mean, but I think it means about the troubles going on now in the UK. That happened when King Henry VIII broke away from the church, made himself Pope, and created the Anglican heresy. I wonder if that also has a role in it. As it says at the end of the part, at the end of the history, back in Normandy, William was seething. He was to build a fleet and army that was to smash Anglo-Saxon land, England forever. Harold's reign was to last just 9 months, and the country was about to be subsumed into the rest of Europe. How long that lasts will depend on that referendum for Brexit held June 23rd, 2016. Just 950 years to the date. So So, well, it looks like I'm not sure about these things. I'll have to do more research after the show, along with my other volunteer work for the order. To study up on the prophecy of St. King Edward the Confessor. Because it sure seems like they go hand to hand. What William was coming into England to do, to get what was rightly his, promised and agreed to. What the wit this council decided Harold should be king because, well, he is English, he's of the House of Wessex, which is true. Edward had no kin. Alright, so let's not dwell on what we don't know right now, and we'll go after I send this little bit, this portion, I can, if it'll let me. Move to the breaking news from Gatestone Institute. Once the page loads again. I don't need to subscribe because I'm already subscribed. This is by Douglas Murray. The three bullet points are: any government genuinely interested in promoting peace would withdraw funding from any entity wherever in the world it was which taught violence as such a core. Another textbook urges that giving one's life, sacrifice, fight, and struggle are the most important meanings of life. This is the true scandal for Britain, that while the UK government fails to pump the resources needed into helping young British children to grow up literally enumerate in Britain, it pumps millions of pounds into the Palestinian Authority to make sure that Palestinian children think that a career of violence is a career worth pursuing. Now, I've always wondered where these textbooks come from that go into Palestine that teach these children how to become terrorists. Now, it is clear they come from the UK. The United Kingdom funds these textbooks, which means the United Kingdom is complicit in the terrorism of terrorist activities of Hamas, because it teaches their of terrorism. Now, I don't like to get tough, but when at times can I get tough, and it's time to tell the blatant truth. Alright, well, you got some Twitter action from that. See if it's going to load. Alright. Okay. Now, do what? In 2016, a study carried out by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, found that for literacy in the developed world, England ranks dead last. Means the kids in England can't read. The same study also stated that for numeracy in the developed world, England ranks second to last, even among graduates from English universities. The OECD study found 1 in 10 had literacy or numeracy skills that were classified as low. Results are astonishing, not to mention shaming. They reflect decades of misdirection, including the misdirection of resources. Understandably, successive governments complain about a lack of resources, but all of those links only serve to highlight the strangeness of Britain's latest in funding education. They don't care about funding the education in Great Britain. They care about funding the education to train terrorists in Palestine. Ooh. When the great universities of Oxford, Cambridge are ranked dead last in literacy and next to dead last in math, they ain't doing a little something off there. When they were beacons of British literature, British science and math. Man, they sure have tore this beautiful country apart. You had the likes of the great literature writers and saints, blessed John Henry Cardinal Newman, who was the Oxford preacher, who also wrote books, and also G.K. Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Hilaire Belloc, all these great English writers. Oh, did I forget? William Shakespeare? I mean, come on, folks. Yep. Let's see what they're doing for the Palestinian schools. This past weekend, it emerged that last year the British government funneled, meaning secretly gave, £20 million to Palestinian schools. A review by the Institute for Monitoring Peace and Cultural Tolerance in School Education, Impact-SE, found that these revenues go towards funding a curriculum which omits teaching peace, promotes the use of violence, especially jihad, and encourages martyrdom. An analysis of the textbooks used in Palestinian schools funded by the UK government using UK taxpayer money? Are you kidding me? People in the UK don't know what their taxes are going towards? Sheesh. Seems like what's going on here in America. Hey, hey, hey. Using UK taxpayer money to fund terrorism and teach it. The Palestine. Are you kidding me? Found that these textbooks, which come from the Palestinian Authority, exerts pressure over young Palestinians to acts of violence. What does that mean? It teaches them how to become terrorists. That is called the lifeline of, or the farm system of terrorism, folks. You know how in baseball they got the farm system where the young players get trained up on how to get better so they can get up to the major leagues? Well, this is the farm system of terrorists, folks. Starts at an early age in grade school, maybe preschool. Like, if you're a Palestinian living in there and your kid comes home from school, oh, what's going to happen today? We learned how to become a suicide bomber. Are you freaking nuts? And UK taxpayers funds this stuff? I'd use other words, but I don't want to because that's as bad. I mean, okay, it's loony, it's nuts, it's crazy, it's idiotic. What are they thinking over there across the pond? Sorry. I just can't believe it. It's just... God bless the United States for breaking free from the crown. Hey, hey, hey. Okay. Oh, here we go. This is about the science textbook. A science textbook intended for 12-year-olds, for example, teaches them Newton's second law of physics in the following way. And I quote from the science book. During the first Palestinian uprising, Palestinian youth used slingshots to confront the soldiers of the Zionist occupation and defend themselves from the treacherous bullets. What is the relationship between the elongation of the slingshot's rubber and the tensile strength affecting it? Let me repeat. This is from the textbook for a science class for a 12-year-old. In Palestine, funded by the UK government, by the UK taxpayers, during the first Palestinian uprising, Palestinian youth used slingshots to confront the soldiers of the Zionist occupation defend themselves from the treacherous bullets? What is the relationship between the elongation of the slingshot's rubber and the tensile strength affecting it? Do you see where this is mad, folks? As Charlton Heston would put, this is a madhouse. Madhouse! I can't believe I am reading this. It reads like a bad comic book. It really does. But it's true. This is what the UK taxpayers fund with their tax money. And yet, their schools are dead last in literature. Dead last. What the great names of literature writers I labeled off for them? Not to mention reading Cicero, Aristotle, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, St. Jerome. I mean, how could it be dead last with these great works? Do these kids not go to the library anymore and check out these books? Or what are they being taught in these literature classes that makes it dead last? I mean, all you gotta do, go up the flight of stairs or take the elevator in your college, go to the library and say, I want to check out this book. Sure, you might get frowned at, scorned at, laughed at, but, well, you might learn something that you don't in the class because these books actually teach you something. They're crying out loud. Well, I can't do anything, but yeah, Bob's freezing up on me. Okay.